It's Friday the 18th of June on RTE Radio 1. I'm Louise Herity. This is Playback Daily, and here's some of what's coming up over the next hour.
Knives, forks, cutlery, random bits of scrap metal, gates, trolleys, and most recently there, the last time we were down, we pulled out a motorbike.
I never thought we'd get to the point where a chain like that would become a kind of a sexualized object, not to mind O'Neill's shorts.
No, I don't really think so, because at the end of the day, there's 30 and 40 year olds who've been offered their vaccine and who have turned it down. So it's not fair for them to still be going abroad and then for 19 to 24 year olds to be told, well, you haven't had your vaccine and you're not allowed to go.
From cutlery to shopping trolleys and even a motorbike, you wouldn't know what you'd find in the canals and rivers of Ireland. And this morning, Ryan Tuberty spoke to Emma Brady about her unusual hobby of magnet fishing.
Hello, Ryan. How are you?
How's it all going over there?
Good now. Great.
What's your day job?
I'm a guard in Stourfleet.
And how's that working out for you?
Great, yeah.
Are you a guard or a community guard?
I'm a community guard.
What's the difference?
What's
the difference, Emma, between a community guard and somebody who's not a community guard?
To be honest, I don't really think there's too much difference. You know, we're always out there and we're always available. So.
And do you love your job?
I do.
Has it been like? Did you find COVID-wise? I mean, we're not on to talk about your job now necessarily, but I would like to ask you: did you find COVID-wise things were quiet or just a different class of busy?
A different type of busy would be probably the best description to describe it as. Yeah. Now, in terms of people and tourists and visitors to the city centre, it would have been quiet in that respect.
Yeah.
But a different type of busy. Yeah, is probably the best way of putting it.
And where did you find yourself gravitating towards in terms of busyness?
Still around the direct city centre, so still around O'Connell Street, Henry Street, Mary Street.
Okay.
That's where I be mostly, but all over really.
All over. And what sort of problems did you confront that might have been a bit different to the usual?
Probably similar to now, large gatherings and, you know, people out and about and people trying to do the right thing, but still, you know, outside of distances and stuff like that. And, you know, some people without even realising, and then others just being difficult.
Just being the maggot, that'll happen, pandemic or no pandemic.
Of course. Let me
ask you, do you like fishing? Are you a fishing woman? Or are you
Fishing.
Have you ever tried fishing before?
I tried it once, and I didn't have the patience for it, to be honest. Sitting there. No, look, don't get me wrong. I know people love it and they really enjoy it, but I just couldn't sit and wait for the little bell to ding.
Where did you try fishing?
Oh, I tried it in my local area here. Yeah. I tried it with my dad and tried it with friends and just, no.
Wasn't for you. Okay, I understand that. I think you hit a point in your life when all you want to do is fish, I think, in some ways, because it's just so peaceful. But you just want to keep going. I totally understand that. And yet, here we are talking about fishing of a sort.
Yes.
Which is what?
Of a sort. Magnet fishing.
Magnet fishing.
Magnet fishing. Not to be misheard as maggot fishing. Magnet.
Yeah, exactly. So does this involve a rod?
No, it doesn't involve a rod. It's a rope.
Okay, you describe for me exactly what you're talking about here.
So I have a very heavy duty with a massive pulling power magnet attached to a carabiner clip, which is similar for hiking or, you know, rock climbing, attached to a heavy-duty rope. And I throw the magnet out as far as I can into an area of water, so a river or a canal or a lake or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just pull it back. And whatever's in there, it's in the water, attaches to the heavy-duty magnet, and I pull it back and take it out of the water.
And is that a hobby or is that part of your community service? I mean, what?
It's a hobby. It's a hobby.
It's a hobby.
It's a hobby. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't do it very often. Since restrictions have lifted and stuff, and I'm back playing football and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't do it as much. It was kind of a day filler. A friend of mine got me into it at the start of the first lockdown, last year. And he does it quite a bit, and I got into it through him.
So, for example, where would you go mostly? Is it, are you talking about the canal in Dublin or the Royal Canal and that sort of thing?
The canal, yes. The canal is one of my favourite spots.
And typically, Emma, what are you pulling out of the canal with your fishing magnet?
Knives, forks, cutlery, random bits, bits of scrap metal, gates, trolleys. And most recently there, the last time we were down, we pulled out a motorbike, a large motorbike.
Okay, now, I've never met you. I don't know if you're somebody of immense strength, but how do you pull a motorbike out with a rope and a magnet?
It was actually very difficult. Myself, my friend who got me into it, and two of his friends who were big into magnet fishing, we met up one morning and we kind of go with the tide. So when the tide is out, you can kind of see a little bit better what's in the water, and we could see the motorbike, and we said, look, we'll give that a go. So we had a couple of magnets each, and we'd have hooks, very strong hooks. Mm-hmm. On our ropes, and we started to pull it up. Now the water obviously helps, because whatever is heavy will become buoyant in the water, so you can move it to a certain point. But when it gets a little more difficult, then there's a bit more pulling power, and the motorbike was very heavy. It was a big Suzuki, a huge big bike. But we managed to get ropes hooked onto different areas around the bike, magnets, and we had a tire and part of like a rope for securing items into a big trolley. We had a piece of that material, so we hooked it under the mudguard at the back.
Of your car?
Of the motorbike.
Of the motorbike,
still
sorry.
In the canal, yeah. And we hooked it up. We ended up having to bring a car up around and pull it out. It was actually just down at the Luke Kelly statue.
Yeah.
Just on Gill Street.
Brilliant.
And we managed to pull it up anyway. And I was able to check the motorbike just out of curiosity, just to see
the reg plate.
There was no reg plate on it at the time; it had been taken off. But I was able to get it checked, and it turns out that the motorbike had actually been stolen.
Really?
It was stolen in September of last year. Yeah.
And dumped. And did you were you able to alert the owner and say good news?
I was. Well, I got on to my colleague who was dealing with it, who was dealing with the stolen bike, the initial incident, and he was able to contact the owner, and the bike was returned to him. Now, I don't know if he was able to go on it, because the bike had been submerged for a period of time in the water, but so good news story from a hobby that started out, you know, due to the pandemic.
And as you said, you meant other people who were into it. So it's a bit of a thing, is it? Magnet fishing.
It's a huge thing. It's absolutely huge.
Right.
I haven't come across anybody else now that's, you know, around the canal or the River Liffey whenever I'm doing it, myself and my friend Richard. I haven't met anybody, but there is evidence of people magnet fishing along the river. You see little bits of rust or, you know, little screws or bits left along, and you'd know that that's the person cleaning off the magnet to throw it back in again. But it's huge in Northern Ireland.
Is it?
Huge in Northern Ireland. There's a Facebook group, and I know I'm not great on Facebook. Don't really use it, but I know Richard has a huge following as well on his Instagram, my own Instagram. But it's huge in Northern Ireland. And only recently, it was on the news there, a group in Limerick, they pulled out a sword.
Yeah.
And it's gone back to, like, was it the early 1900s or late 1800s, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And they brought it to a museum.
Isn't that brilliant?
So
it's like the metal detectors.
Yeah,
might find the Ardagh chalice or something like that. And then
you never know. That's what my dad's hoping for.
Is it? Is he saying?
I might find some chalice or something.
You said you found knives and forks. Anything else of interest? Anything peculiar?
Anything else of interest? I found all reg plates and stuff from old cars. You know, the reg plates with the black writing?
Yeah, old school, yeah.
I've found just random bits and pieces, you know, knives, forks. Some laptops, mobile phones.
Really?
I found a mobile phone there out at the back of Campbell's garage there, at the back of Cabra.
Yeah.
It was a pink iPhone. Picked it out and like that, brought it into work and tried to put it through the computer to see could I find an owner. But I don't think the girl reported it or whatever. But
it's amazing that you're combining your job as a guard with your hobby, which is, you know, magnet fishing, let's face it.
Yeah.
And beyond. So you've mentioned Richie a couple of times, your pal who got you into it. How does a conversation begin with two people about magnet fishing? You know, how did that work out?
I know Richard through work
in
town, and we'll be chatting to him, and he said somebody, one of his friends got him involved in it. And I can't for the life of me remember his friend's name, but he got involved through his friend, and Richard then told me, and I was like, God, that's a great, you know, day out, because you're outdoors, you're you know, you're by water, and you're not sitting waiting for the bell to ring for the now, look, I don't know anything about fishing.
No, I know what you're saying, but
you know, you're throwing it out, you're pulling it back slowly, and the magnet is massive power. So if there's anything within 3 or 4 centimetres of the magnet as it's coming back, the pulling force is going to pull whatever metal object is near it, and it's going to attach to it.
There's a brilliant photo from Totally Dublin by Tom Marr of the bike being pulled out. I'm just looking at it here of the water with your... What class of car is that? And I don't know cars well enough.
That's Kayleigh's car. I think that was a Kia.
Brilliant.
It was a Sportage.
And it looks like a great operation. And
it
must have been... That's like landing a massive salmon. You know, I mean, if you're a fisher person, you know.
Oh, unbelievable.
This is your salmon, you know.
Yeah, unbelievable.
A bike, it's big, and you've got to play it and get it out of the water and onto dry land. And you get a great kick out of that, Emma.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you see something and you have a hold on it, and it's coming, and then... If the magnet lets go, or it comes off, or the rope snaps, it just makes you more determined to get it.
You're describing fishing. You like for, as I say, a trout or whatever. You hope it's going to stay on the fly or whatever it might be, and if it goes, you're gone. You're goosed.
Yeah, you're going after it again.
Yeah, exactly. But because it's magnet fishing, you don't have to be that patient, because you can just keep going, and you seem to be more physically on the move than you would be if you were regularly fishing. Somebody's saying Bondi Treasure Hunter is great magnet fishing. You know of that, do you?
Yeah, he's huge. He goes all over the world, and he started out with just a magnet, you know, and then he just developed it and bigger magnets, and then he went on to, you know, wetsuits, where he's actually getting into the water and he's going underwater, and he's huge on social media, YouTube, everything.
You're also doing quite a service to the environment, let's face it, if you're pulling everything, all the stuff out of the canal and so on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, when you look at bikes and... you know, scooters and wheelbarrows. I think there's a wheelbarrow there in one of the pictures.
Yeah.
Go-karts and stuff. Like, they're not supposed to be submerged in water with wildlife. You know, fish, frogs, everything. They're supposed to be on the road for cycling around, but sure, obviously people don't want them anymore, and rather than put them out for the bin men, or, you know, bring them to the dump, they just throw them into the water.
Yeah.
And, like, the motorcycle was underwater and it was leaking out fuel and oil and all sorts. You know, that's not good for the environment either. So it's definitely better out than in.
Better out than in. You're so right. Emma, I love what you do. It's great fun. And thank you for talking to us this morning.
Thanks very much, Ryan. And thank you.
Garda and magnet fisher Emma Brady on The Ryan Tubridy Show. Well, there's been an influx of people visiting mountains and beaches across Ireland lately, with some areas really badly hit with litter and waste. On Today with Claire Byrne, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to Saoirse McHugh, environmental activist from Achill Island, and Harold Kingston, a dairy farmer from Cort McSherry.
Saoirse, let me start with you in Mayo first off. What's being left behind on Keane Beach?
Oh, well, Keane, I suppose, everyone knows Keane. It's on all the kind of flyers and everything. There's a load being left behind. I think one of the biggest problems I see is... fires being lit, and the ground is just completely scorched, and people throw bottles and stuff into the fire, so there's glass everywhere. Even though the public toilets are now open and there is a port-a-loo there, there's still a lot of people going to the toilet just on the grass, you know, up the hill, up behind the car park, and then just stuff left behind, tents, rubbish, nappies. I suppose a few of us, me and a few people, go down and try and clean up as best we can. But there's just so many people. And I would like to kind of drive home the fact that it's not everyone. You know, the vast majority of people come and camp and leave no trace and leave again. But those that don't, the place is just getting more and more kind of wrecked. And I think if you arrive in a place that's maybe not being treated very well, you're less likely to treat it as well. I know a group down there that rent out kayaks had kayaks stolen recently. And it's just like, we're facing into another summer, similar to last summer, with a huge amount of domestic tourism. And it doesn't seem like any plan has been put in place to deal with it.
If I was somebody with good intentions arriving in Keene, what kind of facilities have the County Council laid on for me to dispose of my rubbish?
There is two small bins. They're like bits of old pipe, you know, that it's like a, I think it's cement pipe or concrete pipe, and they're quite small. So there's two or three of them that are usually, you know, very full, very quick, and that's it.
And there's no way for camper vans to safely empty their toilets? There's no skips for larger waste or anything like that?
No, and I think this feeds into a more general problem about how we kind of treat and manage public space. Like, I don't think Kim requires, you know, large infrastructure or any new buildings or anything like that. Like, I've often thought if we just had a warden, like, you know, in parks in the US, if you had a warden going around making sure people were disposing of their rubbish, obviously, you would need a few more bins, but just making sure there was no fires lit, making sure people weren't, like, just last week, a few people, it looks like, just burnt out a tent right on the beach, and they had blow-up mattresses and everything in it, and it was just like this big puddle of melted plastic that took ages to clean up. So I think something like a warden would really just change the whole...
Yeah. Okay, resources and regulation, I understand that. And when it comes to the cleanup, are the council doing anything, or is it being left to you and other volunteers?
Perhaps the council are doing a bit. Like, I don't want to say they're not. I suppose I haven't seen them. I know they empty the bins. But I and my poor, long-suffering partner, Cullum, he's always dragged along with me. We go down and we clean up often. You know, and it's a bit gross. It's always wipes and, yeah, nappies and all that kind of stuff. It's disgusting, really.
Yeah, no, very, very unpleasant. And fair play to you, both of you, and anybody else who does do it. But do you then have to absorb the cost personally of disposing of that waste, or is there somewhere that you can bring it to?
Oh, no, I leave it right at the Wild Atlantic Way sign for the council to pick up. Like, if I clear it up, they will pick up the bags if they're there. But it is going around picking up the bags. And there's always loads of, you know, those disposable barbecue wires?
Yeah.
And they're lethal in the sand. And it just, like, I've heard the council say they don't have the money for a warden. But like I was saying, you know, Kim is on every brochure for everything. I'm sure they can find some money somewhere to pay for a warden, just to kind of manage how people are treating the place.
And technically, legally, Saoirse, are people allowed to camp on Keane at the beach? Are there no camping signs?
I don't think the sign's there anymore. Or maybe there is, but I believe it's commonage, so people can camp. And personally, like, I really like wild camping, and I think it's definitely something that can be done without negative repercussions. Like, all the national parks in the US you can camp in. And I don't think that we need like a heavy-handed, just closing the beach response. I just think we need in Ireland maybe to develop more of a leave no trace culture. Like, just there at the Whit weekend, I was looking at a video because I didn't bother trying to go back to the beach because, like, sure, you wouldn't get back with all the cars. But I saw a video and there was a load of fires in the evening on the beach, but then there was one halfway up the mountain. And all I could think was, Jesus, if that took off now, you know, you wouldn't get an ambulance back there. You wouldn't get a fire brigade back there. And the place would be destroyed.
Now, I don't want to put you and Harold into conflict straight away, but I wonder on that wild camping thing, would you take a different view, Harold?
No, I wouldn't actually. No, and it's nice to be able to agree with Saoirse on something. But no, look, I'm in a no. Look, in terms of commonage, or whether it's land like my own in enclosed farmland and so on, it's not public land, and that's the key thing to get into people's heads here. When we talk about wild camping and people trying to think of their inner Bear Grylls or whatever, the reality is that you're camping on somebody else's property. You're not foraging for your food. You're bringing lots of plastics and convenience foods, lots of liquids of various strengths and so on as well. In most cases, in what I'm finding, and I think, you know, really it is a case that we need to have this leave no trace concept.
Do you have people who are going into field with cattle?
I've had a few who have discovered that there's cattle there after setting up camping and moved on fairly quickly and so on as well. But yeah, I have people who will flatten out silage fields or there's neighbours who've had.
But from a safety point of view, Harald, it'd be important to tell people that, you know, it's not just bulls that are dangerous when you go into a field.
Actually, the bull is probably the least dangerous animal as such. It's a cow is far more dangerous when it comes to territorial and so on. Now, if there's a bull in the field as well, the cows will become even more territorial. If there's a calf in the field, then extremely dangerous. Looking at a lot of people who come will bring dogs with them as well, and that's increases mm-hmm. it maybe 10 or 20 times. And in particular, actually, in the area that Saoirse is talking about, in the commonage, you know, we and I'm involved in IFA as well, as you're probably aware. We have a no dog policy for any of those areas, simply because of the fact that sheep will become worried very quickly. You know, they don't, you know, even if the dog is on a lead, a sheep will get worried. And if it's the case that they're protecting lambs, then, you know, it could ultimately be dangerous. I've actually put up, I'm part of, there's a walk, actually, public walk crossing my land here. It's part of a longer Seven Heads walk. I was having any of the no dog signs were being taken down. I don't have a problem with dogs on the farm once people keep them under control on a lead. But that I've done in a kind of mathematical equation. So it's dogs plus leads equals safer walkers than happy cows. And people have actually taken to that one, and sometimes it's about informing in a humorous way.
You might add to that equation by saying dogs plus leads minus litter equals safer, happy cows. I mean, what is being left behind, and has it presented dangers to your livestock?
Yeah, so, well, look, and the odd time that I'll actually have somebody set up a tent, there can be tent pegs left in the ground, which are not exactly ideal for a mower if you come across them or whatever. That could gum up the works,
couldn't it?
Very, very, very quickly. Not only that, but look, even animals standing on some of these sharp objects as well. I have problems with silage ground, actually just... probably more problems in an area just beside a roadway that's coming from a beach than it is in the walking area where people are just firing stuff out of car windows and so on. They think it's only one bottle, and they think it seems to disappear once it goes over the hedge, but the reality is that it turns up in my feed and in the winter, and I very nearly had to dump one cut of silage at one stage because there was obviously a bag had been thrown over and it blew across the field, leaving cans and bottles and all kinds of things.
Sorry, so you would have had to dump an entire cut of silage from the whole field because you couldn't tell how far throughout the silage it had been mixed?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Literally it was the case while I was feeding that particular batch of silage, I was searching it every day to make sure, because metal cans will be spotted by a silage harvester because it has a metal detector, but aluminium cans don't get spotted and really? They get shredded. Plastic bottles get shredded and actually can be sharper than the aluminium cans. So yeah, I was watching that. You know,
Has it happened? Do you know of people who have ended up with injured livestock?
Oh yeah, I have.
You
yeah.
have.
Yeah.
What happened?
You'll get cut tongues, or you'll get animals choking and so on. There was a friend of mine actually now to a shopping bag. You know, one of the older plastic shopping bags actually blocked the esophagus, and basically the animal just dyed plastic will build up inside an animal's stomach. It won't pass through necessarily, so it'll build up, and eventually they'll only have half the stomach available. So, it's crazy stuff. The other thing I'm noticing actually as well is that there's an increase in the amount of cans more than plastic bottles, and in particular these energy drinks. There seems to be a lot of that turning up.
Litter is litter is litter. If you bring something someplace, you should bring it away with you.
What I find strange is that the energy drink obviously doesn't give enough energy to carry the can home. yesterday I found two Lucozade bottles. Actually, one of them only half drunk, just on I've an area of rocks, the shoreline. And people just obviously just stopped for their picnic and just left the bottles after them.
Saoirse, can you have wild camping in designated places, though? I mean, I know you say you're an enthusiast for wild camping, or does it need to be done within certain controlled parameters?
I suppose the whole idea of wild camping is that you could camp one night and literally there would be no change in the morning. When you leave, it's like you've never been there. And so if we could have a culture of leave no trace camping, I would, like, and this is my opinion, I would think, like, why couldn't you camp anywhere?
But it is a little bit utopian. I mean, human beings are human beings after all.
I don't know, Philip. Like, loads of other countries can do it and do it very well. Like, I know, like, in the US, it's an on-the-spot fine if you're littering or lighting fires. And I don't think the Irish are just, you know, we're not
uniquely dirty.
Bad. Yeah, we're not uniquely dirty or bad at
we
camping.
Just need
I think
better regulation.
Also on the show, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke about how young unvaccinated people are being told not to travel abroad this summer. He heard from Paul Hackett, the CEO of Click and Go. But first, here's Chief Medical Officer Tony Holohan with his advice last night.
So irrespective of the reason that you haven't been if you haven't been vaccinated, you're not protected. So, and if you're not protected, and you should be protected, then you shouldn't travel. People in that age group, they simply haven't had an opportunity. They can't do anything about the fact that they're not vaccinated. They just haven't been offered a vaccine. Mm-hmm. And yet we're saying to them, we advise against non-essential travel. There are many, many people in that age group. And I think the 19 to 24-year-old age group in particular will be among that age group. If they are not vaccinated, we'll be advising for the foreseeable to not travel.
In a moment, I'm going to speak to one person in that age group, but let's just start first with Paul Hackett, CEO of Click and Go and president of the Irish Travel Agents Association. Paul, I could be wrong, but I can't imagine that you're seeing a huge amount of Leaving Cert holiday bookings, are you?
No, Philip. Like, demand is not strong to book holidays at the moment from any cohort. Like, demand and consumer confidence in international travel is low because of what's happened over the last 15 months. But something like the digital COVID certificate, which covers vaccination, a negative COVID test or recovery from COVID, is a very clear path that the EU have decided on in terms of a safe reopening for international travel.
And when would you have expected, or in the normal course of events, would you have seen Leaving Certs booking those holidays?
Oh, like the Leaving Certs, as soon as they go back to school late August, September, book for the following year. So for the most part, they haven't been booking because there was no option. But we don't expect to see a huge demand from that cohort this year because international travel, all of the restrictions and all of the fines fall away from the 19th of July and the digital COVID certificate comes into play from the 19th of July. So the great thing is, if we look at the reverse of what the CMO is saying, vaccinated people traveling within the EU from the 19th of July have no test requirement, no hotel quarantine, no traffic lights, no emergency brake situation, as is the case we saw with the UK and Portugal. That won't apply within the digital COVID certificate domain.
Okay, but we are talking about vaccinated, fully vaccinated people who have got the second jab as long as a fortnight ago. And that's just not something that's really on the cards for anybody under the age of, well, possibly 30.
Correct. But if we separate out the vaccinated, they have effectively freedom to travel without tests from the 19th of July. The digital COVID cert provides for three things: vaccination, negative COVID test or recovery. So those people who are not vaccinated under the EU-approved scheme by the 27 member states, if they have a negative COVID test result, they can travel. And in Ireland, we're insisting that that test result is PCR, as was evident this week from NPHET and the CMO at the Joint Oireachtas Committee. So if we are insisting that non-vaccinated people, so under 30 who are unlikely to be vaccinated, apply for a digital COVID cert, which they can do so on the grounds of having a negative COVID test result. And in Ireland, we're saying that's PCR. I'm confused as to why we would then be telling those people that they cannot travel. Travel restrictions are gone. Digital COVID cert is in. If they have a negative COVID test result, they can travel. It's up to them. And I understand the public health issue around vaccination, that that is far better position to be in. But these people are not going to have been offered a vaccination.
Okay, well look, let's leave the epidemiology to the epidemiologists and let's just talk about your business. It is hard for families to separate out the unvaccinated under 18. I'm wondering, are you seeing an impact on family holiday bookings as a consequence of that?
Yes, because for exactly the same reason as that cohort from 18 to 30 are not going to be vaccinated. Children from 7 up to 17 are not going to be vaccinated. Children 6 years and under are exempt from the digital COVID certificate. So families are concerned. But, you know, that leaves it in terms of a choice for the family. Families are not booking in terms of volume. And in general, travel is not booking across travel agents in Ireland at the moment. But that is down, I think, to consumer confidence and to an element of confusion around what the digital COVID certs mean. So what we have to do is get the message out there very simply and straightforwardly as to who can travel. And the digital COVID cert is not a vaccination certificate. It was designed in such a way that we were not to discriminate against people who were not vaccinated. We were to offer them the alternative of negative test results or recovery from COVID. So in the case of families, yes, it is tough, Philip, because the children are not going to be vaccinated. So parents have to make a decision. You know, our behaviour in Ireland for the last 15 months has been in compliance with public health guidelines. If we go on holidays abroad, we're more likely to be outdoors more. Our behaviour is not likely to change. It's highly unlikely that we're going to, you know, be in an environment within the EU that has a higher level of infection than Ireland, because let's face it, all EU member states are buying vaccine from the same pot. So all EU member states are being vaccinated at the same level. So for a family, yes, there is a risk. Of course there's a risk, but there's a risk with everything in life. But they need to balance that risk and say, well, our behaviour here has meant the children were not infected, so our behaviour when we're abroad is likewise.
Okay, Paul, let me bring in one of the people to whom Tony Holohan was speaking pretty much directly. Chelsea Farrell, current Miss Ireland and a student in Dundalk Institute of Technology. Good morning, Chelsea.
Good morning. How are you?
You may have been disappointed by what Tony Holohan said last night, but I can't imagine that you were surprised, were you?
No, I wasn't. And I have so much respect for Dr. Holohan. However, I do think the advice that he gave last night was extremely insensitive. And again, he's singling out the age group of 19 to 24-year-olds, which, yes, it is inevitable that the cases are going to be high among that age group. But the majority of the age group is unvaccinated, so that's not their fault.
At different times throughout the course of this pandemic, they've had to hone the message differently for different age groups. Is it not fair enough that at this point in time, given where we are, that he should hone his message, especially for you and your generation?
No, I don't really think so, because at the end of the day, there's 30 and 40-year-olds who've been offered their vaccine and who have turned it down. So it's not fair for them to still be going abroad and then for 19 to 24-year-olds to be told, well, you haven't had your vaccine and you're not allowed to go. But there's a 30-year-old allowed to go who turns down their vaccine. So I think if he was going to give out that message, he should have given it out as a whole instead of singling out a certain age group, because the majority of that age group will be sensible abroad. They'll follow their guidelines like they have done throughout this whole pandemic. They're not all going to go over there and cause havoc. They are going to stick to it. And as Paul was saying, they are going to get their PCR tests and follow all guidelines that's given to them. So it should not have been emphasised that just because they aren't vaccines, they can't travel, because obviously that is not the case.
Okay, well, what should he have said then?
I think as a whole, he probably should have just focused on the message being given out that if you are unvaccinated, there's a higher risk if you travel abroad. However, if you do have your PCR test and you're willing to quarantine when come back if necessary, then it's your choice to travel. Everybody has a choice. And as Paul said there, everything in life comes at risk. Of course, if you're travelling abroad, there's going to be a risk that you might contract something or something could happen. But at the end of the day, there's always risks, and it's an individual responsibility if they want to get their PCR test and travel.
And on an individual level, given particularly as somebody who is in or trying to be in a third level institution, given everything that you have been through the course of the last 14, 15 months, would you really feel comfortable getting onto a plane now and spending 3 hours in the company of people who you just don't know where they've been or what precautions they have or haven't taken?
Yeah, I personally probably wouldn't, but I can't speak for all young people. Young people have suffered so much in the last year with their education, socially, their physical health and their mental health. So it is their choice if they want to take that risk. But at the end of the day, if they're taking all the necessary precautions, then they're doing nothing different than everybody else that is fully vaccinated is doing. If they have a negative test result, then they're fine. And that's the way I look at it.
How are people thinking about having an end of term blowout in Dundalk IT?
Do you know what? I actually only finished up 2 days ago. And to be honest, there's nothing really in the pipeline because nobody knows. No, there's nothing. Because at the end of the day, everyone was kind of planning little trips away and stuff. And when you're looking into prices in Ireland, like students can't afford to pay €1,900 or €1,500 for a weekend in Ireland. But if you look it up online, you can get a week in Tenerife for €500. So students as well can't afford to do staycations and afford to stay in Ireland for holidays. So that's another big problem. But then obviously Dr. Hulin came out and said this yesterday. So everyone's plans are kind of on hold because nobody knows now what
you must actually be wondering at this stage, Chelsea, if you're in college at all.
Yeah, and that's the truth of it. Because, you know, I've been online all year, so I don't feel like a college student. But yes, I'm after passing my first year and passing all my placements, but I haven't even set foot on campus. So we have suffered so much, and it's not fair to continue to pinpoint this age group when we've already suffered enough throughout the whole pandemic.
Okay. Chelsea Farrell
Just one thing. Like, I'm looking at the government website, gov.ie, and it outlines exactly what we have covered this morning. And that is not what the CMO said yesterday in terms of travel for unvaccinated people. So I think it is time the government took control of this. This is an EU initiative across all 27 member states, approved by all 27 member states, and we're not going to any other website other than gov.ie to get our information.
Yeah, I know, that is where we get our information, but the chief medical officer, a scientist who is synthesizing the views of many, many other scientists, has to be free to say what he thinks is the best scientific advice. Government can choose to follow it or not follow it, but you're not suggesting here, are you, that the CMO shouldn't have said what he said?
100% the CMO and anybody else is entitled to their opinion. But we also have a government, an elected government.
Yeah, I know, but and his opinion on these things is perhaps a little bit more informed than yours and mine.
I have to defer to him. I'm no medic.
All right. We'll leave it there then. Paul Hackett, CEO of Click and Go, President of the Irish Travel Agents Association, and Chelsea Farrell, current Miss Ireland. Thank you very much.
That was Philip Boucher-Hayes in for Claire Byrne today. From foreign travel to staycations, Dublin City hotels say they're facing a disastrous summer with only 13% of rooms booked. The city hasn't benefited from the strong demand for staycations around the country. Paul Gallagher is the general manager of Buzzwells Hotel in Dublin City Centre and he's a member of the Irish Hotels Federation. He spoke to Gavin Jennings on the News at One.
No, it's a particularly challenged, Gavin, in the city centre. Some peripheral hotels in Dublin are enjoying better results than that. But Dublin, of all of the areas, and I think Limerick, as city destinations, are finding it much more difficult to attract any volume of visitors to their hotels.
Who is staying in Dublin this summer?
Well, some hotels will have HSE contracts. They will have some contracts for corporates. And there will be some leisure visitors and some domestic leisure at that, but nothing like what we would be used to. 85% of all of Dublin's visitors are overseas, generally. And we know that Dublin Airport's throughput of traffic is down over 90%. So international travel really isn't a feature, and therefore that presents a big problem for Dublin City Centre hotels.
Are you expecting this to be like this for the rest of the summer? Are you writing off this summer for Dublin?
No, we're not. I mean, we were very hopeful that the British market would be coming to Dublin and to Ireland generally. There were 3.6 million British visitors in 2019. But the government have decided that they need to, even vaccinated guests, would have to quarantine for 5 days and produce a clear PCR test. We are really unhappy with that. Whilst, you know, we have our CMO saying this morning that Irish people who are fully vaccinated should try to resume normal life, and yet we're not allowing British visitors who are fully vaccinated to travel freely to Ireland. So, you know, that is a problem. Whilst the British, of course, are not making Irish people travelling who are fully vaccinated to the UK to isolate for 5 days. So we're at odds, really. And Dublin has become one of the most disconnected countries in Europe right through this pandemic, with our airlines collapsing, seat capacity falling, and Ireland, you know, finding lots of reasons not to be able to attract visitors.
When people are contacting you or indeed other hotels in Dublin, are they clear about the travel rules?
Yeah, they are pretty well informed of the travel rules. Obviously, we will try to assist them in making sure that it's as easy as possible for them to visit here. But there isn't that much international demand. The Irish market, I mean, there's terrific value in Dublin, and we wish they would come. You know, our country hotels are enjoying some fairly respectable occupancies, but Dublin hotels still feel quite challenged.
You said terrific value. How much can you expect to pay for a night in a Dublin hotel at the moment?
Well, if you look at hotel sites directly, you'll find the best value, but you will get hotel rooms for €100 and more in Dublin, and there'll be some great offers with dinner, bed, breakfasts as well. So when I say there's terrific value, I absolutely mean that, and my own hotel, I would include in that.
Tell me about your own hotel at the moment. How are you managing to hold on to staff?
We have about half our staff back, and we are trying to keep them all very productive, and they are, and we're doing lots of training. The other half aren't back because we simply haven't got the demand. So it's really important that we do have some staff back, as we wouldn't like to lose them overall, because some of these staff have been off work since March of last year. So it's really critical that we engage as many as possible. And we're communicating all our staff all the time. But I want to be running a busy hotel, not using any government supports, and with all my staff fully engaged and happy.
Understandably, you're impatient for life to return to normal for you as quickly as possible. Realistically, how soon do you expect to be able to run your hotel in the same way that you ran it before the pandemic?
That depends on lots of things, but one of the most important one is the digital cert for COVID travel. We are opening to international travel on the 19th of July. 12 of the 27 EU countries already have implemented and are using that technology to allow visitors internationally within Europe. We need to be up and running by the 19th of July with no delays. And furthermore, I would say that not only the EU 27, but we should make sure that this is also available to North America and to British visitors. It's absolutely crucial that they can come here seamlessly, that there are no barriers and no concerns for them in why they should choose Ireland. It's a beautiful country, we all know that, and it's great value, and we really would like to have them all back here.
In your own case, the dull summer recess is not too far away. Presumably that's going to result in a fall of business for you.
Yeah, it does. We will miss them until they come back in September. They've been terrific. We have managed to have TDs, senators and ministers stay with us right through this pandemic, and only for them we would be in a worse place. I'm very grateful. But normally we would be happy that they go home for the summer, because we would be able to displace that quite easily with some international travel. So that's what we're really hoping for. All we want really is, if Ireland is open, we'll all get on and do our jobs and get all our staff back and provide a great service and a great time for people who visit here.
That was the General Manager of Buswell's Hotel in Dublin, Paul Gallagher, on the News at One. On Morning Ireland, Áine Lawler heard about the latest developments in Waterford, where pride flags were removed and burnt this past month, followed by so-called straight pride posters put up all over the city. She spoke to Executive Director of Belong to Youth Services, Monina Griffith.
Good morning.
Fill us in on what's been happening in Waterford. This isn't getting any better, is it?
No, as you said, there's been great work going on around the country, and we know from Chill Out, the young people, the youth service in Waterford, that they were involved in the Pride of Daisha festival. Flags were raised by the mayor in council buildings and in the mall on the 4th of June as part of that festival, of which took place on the 4th to the 6th. And then in the early hours of Monday the 7th, flags were taken down and burnt. Wednesday the 9th, then the flags were raised again on the mall. And on Saturday the 12th, they discovered that the flags had been taken down again. And then on Friday, the 11th, in the inner city was completely plastered then with these so-called straight pride posters by a group of small, I think what we can call extremists. They're not representative of the majority of people in Waterford City and the surrounds. So deeply disappointing and very sad for the young LGBT people who put mm-hmm. so much work into this with officials and representatives in Waterford to make sure to celebrate LGBT pride and to make sure that LGBT young people were visible, valued and respected in the city.
Not just in Waterford, there's also been incidents with homophobic graffiti in Dublin, haven't there?
Yeah, during the week, the Panty Bar, which is a well-known gay bar, was defaced as well with graffiti, homophobic graffiti as well. That's been removed now. And I really think that, you know, it's a stark reminder that, as you know, as far as we have come over the last decade in Ireland in terms of equality for LGBT citizens with marriage equality and gender recognition for trans mm-hmm. adults, there is still a lot of work to do to dismantle homophobia and transphobia that's deeply held still by some people in Ireland.
The levels of abuse, I mean, despite, you know, the celebrations, and there have been some fantastic celebrations of pride and, you know, the flags everywhere and a community that had to hide their humanity and their love for so long being able to celebrate that. But despite all of that, despite the referendum result, talk to us about the levels of abuse being experienced by LGBTQ people across Ireland and whether the forthcoming hate crime and online abuse legislation, do you think is that going to be enough to change that?
Well, we think it's a really important part of it. It won't be enough by itself, but it's really important to outlaw and address extremist language and behaviour, because we know from, you know, our neighbours in the US and the UK that if you don't address this kind of form of homophobia or transphobia online, it can tend to, I suppose, bleed and that toxicity can have an impact in real life as well. We also know, look, that marriage equality and gender recognition wasn't going to eradicate homophobia or bias and prejudice overnight. There's still a lot of work to do in our schools, in our communities, and even in our homes. We recently did a survey of LGBT young people to find out how they're getting on during lockdown. And it was really heartbreaking, the number of young people, over 50% of them, that said that they were in houses, in homes during the lockdown that weren't fully accepting of their gender identity or sexual orientation. That ranged from just it being ignored and not being discussed right up to abuse and homophobia. So, you know, these examples in Waterford City and Dublin City are very much extreme, and I imagine that they wouldn't be condoned. And in fact, the majority of people are absolutely abhorred by it. But we have to tackle the kind of unconscious bias and homophobic language and behaviour in our schools, in our sports, in our communities, and really need to support parents, guardians and carers to make sure that young people feel valued and respected, irrespective of their gender identity or sexual orientation.
That was Executive Director of Belong to Youth Services, Manina Griffith, on Morning Ireland. And finally, the Irish Film and Television Awards are happening virtually on Sunday, the 4th of July. And Catherine Thomas chatted to the host of this year's event, Gráinne Seoga, on The Ray D'Arcy Show.
Congratulations, first of all. It's your first time hosting the IFTAs. I mean, you've presented awards for so long as well, but this is your first time hosting. So you must be excited.
I'm so honoured, to be honest, Catherine. I mean, I have such respect for what Áine Moriarty and
the Irish Film and Television Academy do every year for the industry, and it's unsung for so much of it. I mean, the Irish Film and Television Awards night is the glamorous tip of a very big iceberg that goes on during the year, and this year has been no different, with all the masterclasses and the online discussions where they bring in these world leaders in filmmaking to sort of educate and inspire, like Martin Scorsese was doing it recently for IFTA. So it's a real honour to be asked to sort of helm a night like that, which is so important to the industry. And the Irish industry is doing so well at the moment, even though we've had COVID.
Yeah. I mean, I had Jim Sheridan on during the week as well. He was saying that he was busy. And again, great things happening. It's been such a year. So many wonderful nominees to celebrate. It's almost like Normal People has just become so huge. It's the one thing that everybody focuses on. Have you seen it yet? Or
do you know what? I heard about Normal People when I was in South Africa. But you know the way certain programs are geo-blocked in different parts of the world.
Yes.
So I didn't get to see it.
Okay.
But my own son's name is Connell, which is the Irish for Connell. So
I'd say he's
Connell
loving that. I'd say he's loving that.
He's getting fat on it. And I never thought we'd get to the point where a chain like that would become a kind of a sexualized object, not to mind O'Neill's shorts. But here we are. Here we are.
And come here, do you know, has it made waves in South Africa since then? Because it's kind of travelled. I mean, the Kardashians were talking about it. Everyone seemed to be talking about Normal People.
I mean, really and truly, they need a trip to Sligo, don't they? They need to go to a Junior B match. Really get the flavour.
That would really get the crowd going. Listen, it's going to be a great night. Cartoon Saloons, Wolf Walkers nominated
Wolf Walkers,
as well.
Yes.
And so it's taking place on Sunday, 4th of July. Obviously, I said it's a virtual event. We can watch it at 9 o'clock on Virgin Media. Is that the case?
I think it's 9 or 10. It could be 10 o'clock actually on Virgin Media. And, you know, last year they had people involved like Martin Scorsese again, Liam Neeson, Ruth Negga, Pierce Brosnan, Chris O'Dowd, the amazing Katrina Balfe of Outlander fame. I don't know if you've watched Outlander.
She is unbelievable.
Isn't she amazing?
Unbelievable.
So we're looking to do another number like that this year. So we're going to be bringing in all these amazing stars, Irish and international. And even though it's virtual, I think that's been the amazing leveller of COVID. We're far more connected to each other almost in a way. This thing of geography is no barrier anymore. So I'm really, really looking forward to all the people I'm going to meet.
And speaking of being connected, I mean, you moved home from South Africa at the end of 2020. Like, how has it been? I can't believe I haven't seen you yet to have a catch-up.
Nobody has seen anybody, Catherine.
I know. Have you settled
in? I believe you got to see my sister recently for the first time in ages.
And you're going to be an aunt. Very soon.
I'm going to be an auntie again of a little girl.
I know. Sure, listen, it's brilliant.
We have had no girls on our side of the family yet.
Oh my gosh, the excitement.
In terms of grandkids. So this princess is going to be destroyed.
Even getting news like that and being on Terra Firma must be amazing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's just something extra about knowing that you're on the same side of the world. And when she appears towards the end of the year, I'll be able to see her, not, you know, being shown pictures online like so many families have had to go through over the last year. It's such a wonderful thing. I've already bagged being a very, very involved auntie.
Oh.
And kind of hedging for guardian status and all the rest of it. So I'm kind of getting that bit in there.
And come here, what was it like moving home during the pandemic? It couldn't have been most stressless experience.
No, moving transcontinentally, I know you're a traveller of note, Catherine, but moving transcontinentally is lock, stock and barrel, we'll say, and then two doggies in tow as well. That's tough at the best. That's if everything is going smoothly. But when airlines are cancelling flights at the drop of a hat, which is what was happening at the time, we learned new levels of patience. And the words were said so many times because, you know, from the time the dogs were meant to come to when they landed, right at the end of the year, there was 3 months.
Oh my God, I can't imagine you without your dogs for that long.
I know. It was really, really hard. It was really... They actually landed the night of the toy show.
Oh God.
So I wasn't watching Ryan, but I was at the airport collecting my own toys and I was like a child on Christmas.
Oh, well, I can just imagine the tears. And to get them back...
I was like a child myself. It was amazing. And thankfully, you know, Abby, who is now 15, went out as a 9-year-old. So she's born and bred Irish. She's from Cork, actually.
Right.
But Murphy, our staffy, came in and he's, you know, smooth haired and a sun worshipper. And all of a sudden now he lands into, like, I think it was 4 degrees that night.
OK.
So, yeah, he has a stunning collection of
coats. He's probably just about acclimatised now.
Yeah, he's getting used to it now. He can handle June and July.
And come here, I was talking about the massive diamond that was discovered in Botswana yesterday.
And that's right.
Of course, you're running your diamond business with Leon. Were you following that story? Obviously, you were.
Oh, absolutely. Every big rock that comes out of the earth, we're all over it. But it's funny, like, big and all as it is, and it looks like an asteroid, it's nothing in comparison to the one that was mined a half an hour from where we lived in Pretoria, called the Cullinan Diamond. That it was mined in 1905, and at over 3,100 carats, it's still the biggest gem quality diamond that has ever been found.
Wow.
So, and that was literally less than 30 minutes from our house.
And
so where we were sort of living and working and building the business is literally steeped in that legacy and that heritage.
Wow.
So it was wonderful for us to have that around us for Grace Diamonds' launch.
And did you feel, I mean, when I was speaking to Gareth from Weldon's yesterday, that even though weddings were cancelled and there was so much uncertainty, that people were kind of displaying, people were still buying rings, people were still quietly kind of doing things for themselves and marking occasions?
Yes, absolutely. I think, for the first little while people sort of got used to everything, things did pause. But you know what, Catherine? Big birthdays still happened. Anniversaries were still happening. Babies were still arriving. Rites of passage were still happening. You know, milestones were still being marked. And where, I suppose, you know, I know you're so close to your friends, you know, you might have gone away on a girly weekend or something for a big birthday. That wasn't an option. So now sort of money that might have been frittered away in town, out of town, going for lunch, that was all being kind of gathered and then put towards something a little bit more permanent. So that's what we found. There was a little bit more consideration around the gifts, and they were really marking, I suppose, a time of your life where something amazing happens, but it's in a tough time as well. And people were doing that. We had a lot of frontline workers who were treating themselves, and a lot of husbands treating their wives because they learned new respect for what was happening at home.
Yes. My husband obviously didn't call, you know. Anyway.
Not yet, but I'm always open for it.
Listen, good
we
luck.
Never close.
Good luck on Sunday with the IFTAs. You're going to do a stunning job. And as you said, the girls, Anya, the girls who run it are phenomenal. And I think the massive respect will come through, as you said, from people all over the world really respecting the industry here in Ireland. So, as I said, good luck.
There is so much talent here, so it's great to celebrate it.
And come here, pop into us again later in the summer if you can, will you? And
maybe we'd love to.
Or maybe I can come west and do a barbecue series with you down there.
Welcome anytime.
Have a great weekend. Thanks, Gráinne.
Slán.
If the host, Gráinne Seoighe, chatting to Catherine Thomas today. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. We're back again at the same time on Monday. But as always, if you'd like to listen back to any of the programmes across the week, you can do that on rte.ie/Radio 1. So for me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.